Tales from Nun's Bottom. Unlikely partners. It's a bit of a cliche, isn't it, that two women running a business together are going to be divorcees of a certain age. Well, I can't help that because it happens to be true in this case. The being divorced and the being of a certain age were the only things these two women had in common, though, because two people less likely to get on together, you would find it hard to imagine. No, I tell a lie, they did have one other thing in common. Actually, something quite important. They shared an ex-husband by the name of Marcus Inch Lomas. How that came about is rather a funny story. If you're interested, I'll tell you it. You might have heard of Marcus Inch Lomas. Do you remember that chap who did all those forgeries of Dutch old masters? Well, that was Marcus. What happened was that the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York bought a Vermeer called the Music Lesson. The previous owner was that Russian industrialist, Vladimir Ostrovsky, the one who had got done over some oil scam and went to prison. Well, unlike Monopoly, in Russia they don't have get-out-of-jail-free cards. You have to bribe someone. And Ostrovsky used the Music Lesson for that purpose. The Russian Ministry of Taking Bribes from Industrialists to Let Them Out of Prison, or whatever its official title was at the time, took the painting and sent it to London to be sold at Sotheby's. Well, the Met got to hear about the sale and sent their representative over with $12 million to buy it if he could. And he could, and he did. Which made them happy, if $11 million poorer. There was change. Which didn't really matter because the money came from the Strelnikov bequest, and everyone knew where that came from. The Music Lesson was duly installed in New York, and everyone came to admire it, including Julius Veszbringer, the acknowledged world's leading expert on Vermeer. Well, he was acknowledged by a lot of people, but you know what it's like in the art world. One person's expert is another person's fraud. And according to Jean-Luc Grillet, he was the acknowledged world's leading expert on Vermeer, and Veszbringer was a fraud. The argument between them had been going on quite publicly for more than 20 years, and it was both acrimonious and entertaining, if not for them, at least for observers in the art world. Well, Grillet had been commissioned by the Met to accompany their man over to London and check the picture out before they bought it, and he declared it the real thing, and so it was duly purchased for the aforementioned $11 million. Of course, Veszbringer knew all about the acquisition, and he couldn't resist paying the Museum of Art a visit to see it for himself. I hardly need to tell you, he saw immediately it was a fake. There was a great hue and cry about it. The director of the museum was called down to the painting, where Veszbringer publicly rebuked him for being taken in, and so upset was the director, he called two burly security men and had Veszbringer removed. By now, though, a crowd had gathered round the Music Lesson, and the director had no choice but to have it removed from the wall. It was on the 6 o'clock news that very day, in the New York press the next morning, and London the next. In his flat in Knightsbridge, Marcus Inch Lomas smiled. He knew the truth, of course, and he didn't care if it came out, because he had been paid. And what's more, the money had been spent on a rather sleek boat currently moored at Cannes, and they can't take that away, can they? Well, they probably could, but they would have to trace the money back to the people who bought his copy of the Music Lesson, and that would be impossible. The truth was that the original of the painting had been stolen from the Hermitage in Leningrad while it was on loan from the Vladimir Ostrovsky Foundation. No one knew it had been stolen, though, because in best thriller tradition, it had been replaced by the superb copy Marcus had produced. So it was the copy that went back to the owners who sold it to pay the bribe, and that arrived in New York to be outed by Julius Veszbringer. This is complicated, but do try and keep up. The original painting had, of course, been stolen to order, and that order came from Kostas Konstantinos, the Greek shipping magnate and art collector. He was Marcus's patron, or you might say fence, as he encouraged him to copy a number of famous works of art, which he then arranged to hang in the place of the originals. And once every 5 years, he arranged an exhibition of his originals, which of course he said were copies but weren't really. Why did he do that? I suppose for the thrill of seeing people wonder at the skill of the copier while they were actually looking at the originals, knowing that in museums and galleries all over the world, people were looking at fakes and wondering at the skill of the Dutch old masters they thought had painted them. In other words, it was a joke. Constantinus had a well-developed sense of humour. He had always thought the art world was plain daft, the way it declared one painting original and worth millions, and another copy, another a copy, and worth nothing. What was the difference? Even funnier was when a painting always thought to be original, and therefore worth millions, was suddenly declared to be a mistake on the part of the world's leading experts, and now worthless. He thought the art world was inhabited by fools, and he thought it perfectly legitimate to make fools of them. I don't know how he and Marcus Inch Lomas got together, but it was a marriage made in heaven. Marcus had the talent and Costas had the money. And by a mutually beneficial arrangement, Costas obtained the result of his talent while Marcus obtained some of Costas's money. Everyone was happy. Until the music lesson arrived on the wall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There was a tremendous hoo-ha, and everyone said what a terrible thing it was that a painting that was supposed to be original and worth millions was only a copy and worth nothing. It's a disgrace, and someone should go to prison for it. Only one newspaper, the Yonkers Times and Chronicle of Yonkers, New York, saw the funny side of it and said, "Hey, who cares? Perhaps the copier is as good as Vermeer." Actually, the editor of the Yonkers Times and Chronicle wasn't such a fool. But since no one in the art world of New York even read the Yonkers Times and Chronicle, they didn't know he said it, and even if they had, they would have said poo. Well, Marcus didn't go to prison because, of course, he wasn't apprehended. But he did decide to lie low, and where better to do that than on his yacht on the south of France? It was there that he met Sue Featherby, who was working at the time for a French yacht brokerage firm. Sue was everything you would expect of a woman working for a yacht broker in Cannes. She was elegant, she was bright, and she was darned attractive. While Marcus had been in New York, a minor German newspaper proprietor on holiday in Cannes had fallen in love with his boat, Jet d'Eau, and had asked the brokerage to inquire if the owner would consider an offer. When Marcus arrived in Cannes, Sue contacted him and asked, but he said no, and then he asked her if she would have dinner with him, and she said yes, and that's what they did. The rest of that particular story is frankly a bit sordid, and in deference to the squeamish among you, I shan't go into what happened aboard Jet d'Eau that night. However, 3 months later, Marcus did the decent thing and proposed to Sue, and she said yes, and they did the usual wedding thing, and before they knew it, they were a married couple. Everything worked out pretty well until the day a police officer from the French Fine Arts Squad came to the boat and asked for Marcus. She said he wasn't on board, which was true, and the officer went away, but said he would be back. You know, in that way they say it, so you feel them coming back might be unpleasant. Well, when Marcus returned, she told him about the police officer, and his facial colouring changed a shade or two, and she knew he wasn't innocent, whatever it was he might be accused of. And believe it or not, she had forgotten, in the passion of the moment before they got married, to ask Marcus what it was he did for a living. Sue had always mixed in those circles where people didn't necessarily do anything for a living, they just kind of lived. Her own job at the broker's was more a social thing than actual work. But now she did ask him, and he, like a fool, told her the truth. And instead of thinking what a terrible thing it was, Sue just laughed and said she thought it was funny, and Marcus laughed, in relief probably, because she wasn't angry, and that meant she wasn't going to shop him. But when he said he was going to take the boat over to America, she stopped laughing and said she didn't think so. For a woman who worked for a yacht broker, she might be very elegant and bright, but she didn't actually like the sea, and the Atlantic Ocean is a hell of a place to be in that case. So Marcus said he would take a couple of friends to crew the boat and she could fly over, and she agreed. A week later, Sue arrived in New York and settled into a comfortable hotel to await her husband's arrival. She waited, and then she waited some more, and then she called the Coast Guard and inquired about Jet d'eau sailing from the south of France, and was told they were terribly sorry, but the yacht was reported missing, last heard of just south of the Azores, where a tanker had picked up a distress message from her. The US authorities listed him as missing, presumed dead, even though no trace was ever found of the Jet d'eau. So Sue was a widow, pretty cut up about the loss of her husband after such a brief marriage, but at the same time jolly grateful she hadn't been on the boat with him. She returned to Cannes and resumed her life more or less where she had been before she met Marcus. She even went back to using her single name, so after a while it felt to her like the whole affair had been a dream. Except that some months later she returned to London, and it occurred to her she should contact Marcus's solicitor, because she was, after all, probably in line to inherit his estate, and that, she thought, would be nice. Imagine her surprise when she arrived at his office at the appointed time, only to find her late husband there. Except that he wasn't late at all, he was very much on time, if you see what I mean. It seems that when Marcus heard Sue was looking into his financial affairs, he decided the scam had gone far enough, and it was time to put a stop to it. Well, to cut a long story short, Sue was not at all amused by this turn of events, and told Marcus so, and they had a bit of a row, and the solicitor said he also handled divorces, could he interest them in one, and they thought they might as well while they were there, and before she knew it, Sue was a divorcee, as well as a widow, because as part of the settlement she was asked not to tell anyone her husband was still alive, and for a couple of Dutch old masters, only one careful owner, she agreed. It was then that Marcus bumped into his second wife, or the woman who was going to become his second wife. As he was coming down the stairs from the solicitor's front door, he collided with her because he was preoccupied and she was carrying a lot of shopping and didn't see him coming. She fell backwards rather badly, whereas Marcus found he made a soft landing, on reflection, a rather agreeable soft landing, Angela D'Souza being the sort of woman you would want to land on if you had to land anywhere, I mean, if you were a man. Angela was on holiday from South America, where she lived with her lover, Eduardo D'Souza. It would be more accurate to say she was on holiday from Eduardo D'Souza, because in truth she was finding him tiresome, and she felt herself in need of a holiday. So she combined the chance to see her parents in England with the chance to spend some of Eduardo's money, and all in all was having a good time. Until she bumped into Marcus Inch Lomas and did the closest thing you can get to sexual congress in a London street without getting arrested. As they lay there for the brief moment it took for the two of them to gather their wits, Marcus looked into the dark pools that were Angela's eyes and drowned. Angela looked into Marcus's eyes and thought, what the hell is this man doing on top of me, doing an impersonation of a love-struck whale? That was only for a second, because as he lifted his weight off her, she thought she rather liked being laid on by this man, and by the time he had struggled to his feet, she had noticed he wasn't wearing a wedding ring, so when he offered to take her for a coffee to apologise for assaulting her in this way, she lowered her eyelids in a most fetching way and accepted. Marcus didn't notice, but she too was not wearing a wedding ring. That was because she and Eduardo D'Souza had never actually got around to getting married, despite her use of his name. It was at that moment that Sue came down the steps from the solicitor's office, just in time to see her late husband disappearing down the road with a strange woman and his arms full of parcels. It was the first time she ever caught sight of Angela D'Souza, but not the last. Only the next time she was called Angela Inch Lomas, and she, like Sue, was divorced from Marcus. And just so you don't think women didn't like being married to Marcus, in this case it was he who left her. A friend of his, Ronnie Gore, had a business in the city, London that is, doing something or other, whatever it is people do there. He was successful at whatever it was because lots of people gave him their money. I imagine on the basis that he would turn it into more money for them. But one day everything went into reverse, as these things have a nasty habit of doing, and the people who had given him their money wanted it back. Unfortunately, Ronnie hadn't foreseen this eventuality, which I suppose is the difference between a good businessman and a bad one, and there wasn't enough in the bank because he had forgotten it wasn't his money and spent some of it, well, rather a lot of it. He did have the lease on the office space, and his creditors took that, but what with it being a poor market generally, no one wanted to buy it from them, and well, frankly, they lost their money, and between you and me, do we feel sorry for them? Anyway, that's by the by. Marcus happened to mention to his erstwhile sponsor, Costas Constantinas, that the offices were going cheap, and the word cheap interested Costas, and he had his agent take a look, and in no time had bought the lease. They were rather nice offices, in a Georgian building in a fashionable part of town, and Marcus thought they would make a good gallery. He had more than enough paintings to fill the place, and the opening was a glittering social occasion attended by many of the leading people in the arts world. Angela was responsible for the design, and as she was a lover of indoor plants, the place resembled Kew Gardens as much as an art gallery, but even Marcus had to admit the profusion of greenery set off his copies of Old Masters rather well. For the first time in his life, Marcus was running a legitimate business, albeit not in his own name, having decided you never know when it might be handy if people think you drowned in the Atlantic Ocean years ago. Old habits die hard. The gallery did very well, actually, and soon they were selling pictures faster than Marcus could paint them. It might only take 10 minutes to sell a copy of The Girl with the Pearl Earring, but it takes months to paint it. Angela found she was buying more pot plants to fill the gaps, and soon the gallery went from pictures interspersed with plants to plants interspersed with pictures. She nagged Marcus to work faster, but he said you can't rush these things, and of course he was right, you can't. So she bought more plants, and before long it looked more like a florist than an art gallery. In fact, so green did it look that one day the senior partner for a big firm of solicitors happened to be talking to Angela in the gallery, and he asked her where she got the plants from, because he would like a display in his office, and she said she would come round and have a look, which she did, and he asked her to create a display for him, for a fee of course, and she agreed. His partners saw the result and asked who had done it for him, and he gave them Angela's name, and soon city people were finding their way to the gallery, not to buy paintings, of which there were by now very few, but to commission Angela to create a green office for them. Without any intention of starting a business, Angela found herself so busy on commissions she didn't have time to run the gallery. Now, instead of her nagging Marcus to paint faster, he was nagging her to concentrate on art, not plants. Soon they were arguing about it regularly. In fact, they argued so much Marcus found he couldn't paint at all, and they were faced with closing the gallery. They didn't close it though, because it served Angela very well, and they simply changed the name on the door to Office Beautiful, and Angela paid rents to Costas. Commissions kept coming in, and Angela became so busy with Office Beautiful she didn't notice what Marcus was doing. In fact, Marcus wasn't doing anything. She needed someone to go round to all her clients and look after the plants, and suggested he might do that, but he laughed at the idea. When he realised she was actually serious, he became angry and stormed out of the house. He didn't come back until the next day, and they made up. But it was only a few more weeks before they had a bigger argument, and he stormed out again. And soon he was away more than he was there, and soon after that, he didn't come back at all. Angela was so busy she hardly noticed. She was having a great time and earning good money. Then one day, a woman walked in and asked for Marcus. She had heard he had been selling paintings there and wanted to speak with him. Angela said she didn't know where he was, but they stood there and looked at each other as if they had met before, but couldn't think where. And Angela said, sorry, she couldn't help, but gave the other woman her card, which said, Office Beautiful, Angela Inch Lomas, proprietor. Sue stood and stared at it, and then at Angela, and then she remembered where she had seen her before, walking away from the solicitors with Marcus. Well, Angela and Sue became friends that day. Sue hadn't really found what she wanted to do with her life and was getting tired of not having a purpose. One day, When after an evening out with Angela, the latter said, why didn't Sue come into the business with her? And she said yes. So now the two ex-wives worked together, and then one day Marcus came back and walked into Office Beautiful and stood there, unable to believe his eyes. And Angela and Sue helped him to a chair and made sympathetic noises, but really they thought it was funny. They never saw him again. Things went well, but the next year Costas wrote to tell them the lease was running out on the premises and they would, he was afraid, have to find somewhere else. They found that harder than they expected, because they hadn't actually been paying a commercial rent to Costas, and now they found they couldn't afford a city base. In fact, by the time they found anywhere they could afford, it was way out of London altogether, too far for their clients to be able to look after the plants. Then, by one of those strange and frankly hard-to-believe coincidences, Sue's aunt died, or it might have been her great-aunt, don't hold me to it, and left her a house. Well, more like a mansion, somewhere in Hampshire. Sue invited Angela to go down and look the place over, and when they got there, they both fell in love with it. It was, to be strictly accurate, quite a small mansion, but by London standards it was fabulous, not least because it stood in 13 acres of land, an unimaginable luxury to the two women. And what's more, there were greenhouses, rows and rows of them. Sue's aunt, or great-aunt, had been a melon fanatic. You probably didn't know there even are such things as melon fanatics, and for all I know, there aren't, and her aunt might have been the only member of a very small club. But she spent 30 years growing the things, and had been so successful, her melons went up to London to be sold in shops like Harrods and Fortnum and Mason. It was a condition of her will that Sue, who was not at all close to the old woman, but was her only living relative, would keep the melons going, along with Alfred, her gardener for the past 30 years. When Sue and Angela met Alfred, their first instinct was to find him a chair, because he didn't look like he could stand up for long periods. In fact, Alfred was 87, having come to the old woman's employment late in life. The secrets of the melons apparently resided in Alfred's gnarled and discoloured hands. Sue reckoned Alfred wouldn't last long, and she would be able to stop growing melons once he went. She thought that's what her aunt meant, keep the melons going for Alfred. They calculated the house was about an hour from central London by car, and that this would do as a base for Office Beautiful. Alfred would be able to help with the plants, perhaps. It didn't quite work out like that. Alfred flatly refused to die, and a year later, Sue and Angela realised they would have to find more space because he wasn't going to relinquish greenhouse space or potting shed room for their plants. And that, as I promised, is the story of how the two ex-wives of the famous artist Marcus Inch Lomas came to be in business together, and by the way, how they happened to be tenants at Nun's Bottom.